Hello, I'm Ivan Berg, and this is my story. Part 7, 1954 to 1955. On my first trip to New York on the Lizzie, I went ashore with $5 and came back on the bus from Times Square with just a quarter in my pocket. The $5 was my share of the plateman's tips paid by the waiters. I seem to remember the going rate was $1. The three platemen were at the bottom of the pile of the tip-sharing system. Before us came the cooks, the pantrymen, and the glory hole stewards. If you were a waiter or a lounge steward, cabin steward or stewardess, you would expect to give away a quarter or even as much as a third of your tips. After just the one trip as plate man, I was promoted to cabin class kosher pantryman, the job that Uncle Teddy's friend's friend had organised for me. He was the kosher waiter, and I've forgotten his name, so I'll call him Jack. He was tubby and small and a bit of a bully boy, but boy did he make tips. I never saw him at work, but he was able to josh his American Jewish bloods into paying $20 a head by offering, jokingly of course, $10 or $20 service. The exchange rate then was approximately $3 to the pound. So with 12 bloods eating kosher, that was £80 each way. As kosher pantryman, it was my job to maintain the stocks of cold kosher food in the kosher pantry and serve portions on plates, as required by the kosher waiter. Among the items I remember carrying up from the kosher cold food store in the working alleyway were large bottles of Manischewitz borscht, packs of matzahs, and tubs of chicken liver pate and gefilte fish. The hot kosher food was prepared by the kosher chef. The menu was fairly limited compared to the main restaurant menus, so I can't say I ate very much, except for the occasional chicken liver pate on matzah as a snack if I was feeling peckish. As there was only one kosher waiter, my share of tips was limited to a miserly $20 each way. Fortunately, I only did two trips as a kosher pantryman because I was asked to help out in the writer's office as they were short-staffed due to one of the writers taking a few trips off to deal with a family problem. So, plate man to kosher pantryman to the job of assistant writer in just three trips, around 6 weeks. The writer's office was close to the kosher cold food store, and I passed it a lot. A nodded hello turned into a quick chat. I commented on the American Smith Corona upright typewriters they were using by saying that I had only used Royals. One thing led to another, and the chief writer asked me if I had any office experience. I mentioned Pitman's College and journalism, and hey presto, I was next in line for the really very, very plum job of assistant writer. To the great annoyance of Jack the kosher waiter, who had to find another Jewish kosher pantryman. And Jewish catering staff in the British Merchant Navy were as rare as, well, as Jewish catering staff in the British Merchant Navy. In the writer's office, I was privy to the Cunard underworld. Although it was our job to ensure that the catering department was fully staffed with trained and experienced people, we maintained our own lists of recommended staff, hence the clipboard in the dockside office, there were some jobs that were just rubber stamped. a barman's job, for instance, changed hands for large sums of money and had to be approved by the chief barman. Any job that had anything to do with drink was worth a lot of money, and the job of chief barman was top of the pile. It was easy to understand why. It went right back to the early days of passenger liners. The job of chief barman and the barmen and wine waiters were effectively franchised, although they signed ship's articles and were always administered like the rest of us. The reason was the chief barman bought all his own booze at a discount, negotiated with his chosen supplier in Southampton, and sold it on to each barman at an agreed profit. The amounts involved were astronomical, given the size of the ships and the number of bars and passengers. I was told, anecdotally, that the chief barman drove a Bentley, had a large detached house with swimming pool and tennis courts, and sent his children to private schools. The booze business worked all the way down to the lounge stewards and wine waiters. The barman bought the stock for their bars at a discount from the chief barman and added their own markup. Lounge stewards and wine waiters had to keep a cash float that was used to pay for the drinks that passengers ordered, and then the passengers paid cash or kept an account for the trip with a steward or wine waiter, who also had a markup and tips. Of course, the passengers only paid the prices printed in the bar and wine menus. We writers also had perks, part-time jobs that allowed us to make tips. The best examples were evening work as lounge and bar stewards, or, best of all, manning the doors each side of the first-class restaurant. Boring stuff, but with a ship full of 700 or 800 passengers in first class, two of us writers could really cash in at the end of each trip. A couple of $100 each way was not at all unusual. We did provide a service for, apart from the door opening and hundreds of good morning, good evening, sirs and madams. In the evening we had coloured after-dinner mints on cake trays and piles of the ship's postcard with the day's run printed on the back. This was important as passengers could place bets on the distance travelled by the ship over the next 24 hours, mostly between 600 and 700 nautical miles. Leaving New York cocktail parties were traditional on board both the Queens for first-class passengers. We sailed from New York in the late afternoon, and passengers could give cocktail parties for relatives and friends who came to see them off. These took place by arrangement in the first-class lounge. The favoured drink was champagne cocktail. Canapés, of which more in a moment, were provided on large silver trays. In theory, the cost of the drinks would be charged to the passengers' account, and this would be settled after the ship sailed. In practice, one of the passengers' guests, usually tipsy, would insist on paying. We would then produce a bar bill for the number of bottles of champagne used. No mention was made of the canapés, as these were free. If this was queried, and depending on how drunk the guest was, we would make a charge of $5 a tray. This was seen to be very reasonable, given the amount of caviar canapés in a tray. A party of 10 would probably get through 4 to 6 trays. There were usually at least half a dozen leaving parties. Though not all the bill payers were drunk, a good number of them were, and they were unlikely to remember paying for the canapés. The barbell, again depending on how tipsy the payer, could also be inflated by a couple of bottles of champagne. In the unlikely event of the number of bottles consumed being challenged, a few extra corks were always at hand to be counted. There was also a tip. This could be anything from $10 to as much as $50. The settling up was always done in a rush after the second all ashore that's going ashore PA announcement and the blasts of the ship's horn. Then there were the goodbyes, the hugs and kisses and tears, and then down the gangway they went, waving, while we retired to the pantry with the chief lounge steward to count the spoils and settle the actual bar bill. Our scams could only work in New York, and then only with American parties. The goodbyes for the Southampton sailing were said at Waterloo Station before the boat train left. With money to spend, I soon became the Cunard Yank I once imagined myself to be. First of all, a suit from Brooks Brothers, except that it wasn't. I was sent to a Chinese tailor recommended by the chief writer. I could be measured up for a suit and it would be ready to collect when the ship next docked in New York. When I said I really wanted a Brooks Brothers suit, the tailor pulled out a swatch of suit labels. "You want Brooks Brothers?" he said. "I give you Brooks Brothers." So I had a copy of the three-button, narrow-lapel, fashionable $200 Brooks Brothers suit with a Brooks Brothers label for $25. I bought pin-through collar, double-cuff, Seal Island cotton shirts at four for $10, four sets of cufflinks with matching collar and tie pins, and a pair of sharp Italian-style shoes. A few trips later, I added a sports jacket and slacks and an overcoat, a pack of Chesterfields in my shirt pocket, and a Zippo lighter always to hand, and I was complete. With no friends in New York, for a lot of the time I went around on my own. I went to the top of the Empire State Building, visited museums, saw a show at the Radio City Music Hall, listened to jazz at Birdland, and walked Central Park. I said I had no friends, but I did have a relative. Uncle Monty, the dress cutter, had been offered a job in the garment trade in New York at around the time I went to sea school. His letters to the family sung the praises of America and New York. He was making lots of money, was in touch with some American cousins, and was having a great time. He had heard that I was working on the Queen Elizabeth and was looking forward to showing me the town. I did visit him in his apartment somewhere on the east side, having phoned him from the ship and been invited to dinner. I was introduced to Monty's friend, also in the rag trade, who was making the food, and after some small talk about my job on the ship and offering me a drink, Monty said that he had an appointment and went off, leaving me alone with his friend. Almost as soon as the door closed, the friend sat down next to me on the sofa, thigh to thigh. I had been procured by my queer Uncle Monty for one of his very camp friends. I left. Every five round trips, the catering staff had a trip off. So every 3.5 months, I had a fortnight in London to see friends and spend my money. I bought an LD125 Lambretta motor scooter to travel to and fro from Southampton. I spent a lot of time with Rennie and Sam at the Nest and stayed there regularly. Rennie said that the scooter had to have a name and decided on Proserpina, the Roman goddess of fertility and queen of the underworld. Rennie also presented me with an Olivetti Lettera 22 portable typewriter, saying that it was about time I started writing. I met up once more with Nick Britton, who was staying with one of Rennie's friends in Handel Street. Having been shown the door by Rennie for being caught attempting to smuggle some cannabis and being summarily dismissed from the Merchant Navy, Nick was being bedded by, I hesitate to say, an older woman, because Anne Bailey must have been all of 23 to our nearly 19s. Nick's birthday was in July 1955, mine in March. Anne played acoustic guitar and had a rather pleasant singing voice. She was, Nick informed me with some pride, an actress, and was a member of Unity Theatre. Anne shared a large mansion flat near King's Cross with a butch friend called Margaret and a very Jewish-looking man called Lionel. Lionel was Lionel Begleiter, soon to change his name to Bart. All three were enthusiastic members of Unity Theatre, a theatre group that had links to the Communist Party, although they all claimed to be non-political. Lionel ran a small silkscreen printing company called G&B Arts with John Gorman, an ex-Royal Air Force National Service friend, in Morning Lane, Hackney, just round the corner from my parents' prefab. Although Lionel was homosexual, he never made a move on me. He called me Boy Chick, which was an affectionate Yiddish term for a young man. It had no sexual connotations. When he discovered my mother's chicken soup, he turned up a few Friday evenings at supper time while I was away to join in the evening meal. Sometimes, according to Michael, he even had a bath. Anne Bailey was very attractive, and I have to say I was rather envious of Nick. Until, that is, Anne turned up at the Crow's Nest one afternoon when I was alone. She said she was looking for Nick, but that was a pretext. As I knew, she knew, Nick was staying in Handel Street. Anyway, I made coffee and we chatted, and then I nearly dropped my cup when she suggested we go to bed. And we did, for hours. And I enjoyed myself enormously and didn't dare tell her it was my first time. Though I'm sure she knew. She said that I wasn't to tell Nick, and I didn't. It never happened again. Lionel later warned me about Anne, saying that she was very lovely, but she did like to pop young men's cherries. I didn't tell him I'd already been popped. Nick introduced me to the Yellow Door crowd, a group of ex-St Martin's School of Art friends who partied in a small terraced house near Waterloo Station. It was in a narrow street called The Cut, and it had a bright yellow door. It was rented by Maurice Agis, a painter, and shared with Mike Pratt and, I think, Bert Braham, both in advertising. I also remember Derek Jameson, John Michel and John York. Of the girls, I can only remember Maureen, who I think eventually married Bert. I remember her because she broke a toe when riding on Nick's Vespa. Morris became a sculptor and eventually invented the Dream Space, inflatable walk-through sculptures. One of which, Dream Space 5, became loose from its moorings in a high wind, killing two people and injuring 13 others in July 2006. Mike Pratt wrote songs with Lionel for Tommy Steele and then took up acting, mainly for television. He was best known as the ghost of Jeff Randall in the TV series Randall and Hopcote Deceased. Derek Jameson became editor of the Daily Express, John York, an antique dealer, and John Michel, a property developer. There were two other meeting places where I could always be sure to find one or more of the door crowd whenever I was in town. One was a very cheap Italian cafe in Little Compton Street, and the other a basement club in Dean Street called the Caves de France that had an old honky-tonk piano. Mike Pratt played it rather well, getting free drinks from Madame Marie, the owner, in the process. And then it was back to the Lizzie, and backwards and forwards across the Atlantic in fair and foul weather. In May 1955, I was asked if I wanted to join the Mauritania, currently in dry dock, being prepared for cruising the Caribbean out of New York. I would join as a writer. My perks for tips would be wine waiter and lounge steward. I signed on.